Good morning. Good morning, everyone. I'm waiting for Sarah to start recording, and then we're going to get started. So I'd like to welcome you all to our third and final seminar in our series, Sowing Seeds of Justice, Food Security for All. And she hasn't started recording yet. No, that's just for you. Thank you. This morning, we're going to hear from three local groups, 412 Food Rescue, Community Kitchen, and Seed to Supper. The format for this morning is as follows. Carol Galbreath is going to be our interviewer, and she's going to introduce and speak with each of the agency representatives individually. Then she's going to invite them back to the front for a question and answer session. So we ask that you please hold your questions until Carol opens this part of the session for your questions. Thank you. Now I give you Carol Galbreath.
Good morning, everyone. So before we get started, let me open us all with a word of prayer. God of us all, we thank you for the people in these local organizations who have seen where your people are hurting and are addressing that need. We ask for your blessing this morning as they share their stories. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen. So we're going to get started today with 412 Food Rescue, and I'll invite Greg Austin, Chef Greg, to come join me and give him the mic he needs. Also from 412 Food Rescue, we have Haley Baston with us. So I ask you to welcome her as well. Chef Greg, you're the project manager of the Good Food Program. How did you come to be involved in 412 Food Rescue?
Thanks, Carol. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay, wonderful. I came to work with 412 Food Rescue about 3 years ago in May of 2020, peak pandemic. I come from a food and beverage background. I've been cooking in Pittsburgh for about 15 years, 13 years. I had always, as a chef, come across waste. It's an inevitable part of the structure of how we work, of the industry. And it had always disturbed me. And I'd always, as a chef, you want to cut that waste down just because it's a cost to you. But there's an emotional aspect to that as well. And living in a city like Pittsburgh, where need is as visible as it is, there's a guilt there as well. And so when I heard what 412 Food Rescue was doing, I worked with them from the chef end. I'm a little closer, a little more. Thank you. So when I saw what 412 Food Rescue was doing, it gave me an outlet as a chef to be able to redirect some of my own kitchen's waste. And in the pandemic, things slowed down for restaurants and an opportunity came across my desk and I had to take it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, 412 Food Rescue, the food rescue part, I mean, it's a great name because it really conveys the urgency with which you have to deal with perishable food. You've got to be quick about it. So where else does this waste occur? You mentioned restaurants, but even households or what other places do we see waste of perishable food?
Anywhere that there's food, we typically work with front-facing, customer-facing businesses like food distribution centers, restaurants, grocery stores.
Okay.
Those are our typical areas where we can grab the food and be able to distribute it directly in that short time frame that you mentioned.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a logistical challenge there at the very least. So in what ways do you redistribute this food that you can do that so quickly where it's still going to add value?
Sure. We have two methods. Typically, we have our own fleet, which is how the organization got started, which is a couple of trucks, box trucks, refrigerated vans and trucks that we use to do the bulk pickups. If we get to a partnership with a grocery store or a larger site, you know, it's easier for us to put a whole loading dock's worth of stuff in a box truck than it is in a multiple volunteers' cars. But we also have, since 2017, mobilized volunteers just like yourselves using an app.
Okay.
And so they help us also distribute that to more and more points.
So the app tells them where they need to
go
do the distribution.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow. That's great. So, you know, you mentioned the need in Pittsburgh and the need being visible, but how do you identify the recipients and coordinate that and to know who needs this food and who needs it today?
We have a whole department dedicated to that, as well as another group on the other side. So there's recipients, which is who you're asking about, and there are donors.
Okay.
And we do a lot of work organizing them and checking in with them and making sure that they want to be active and are still active on both ends. And then day to day, our dispatch is another department that connects those two dots using the app.
Okay. Yeah. And the recipients, did they contact you or are you made aware of them through other need organizations?
All channels, every channel we can get to.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So you're involved with one aspect called the Good Food Project. Can you tell us about that and what that angle is?
Sure, absolutely. So another part of our work is, I'll start with this. In that direct distribution model, we're picking things up from grocery stores, distributors, kitchens, and moving it directly to mostly partner sites, mostly the nonprofits that you're asking about, and they can help us distribute it into the communities. We were noticing that because we move on such a quick timeline, some of the food, we can't organize the food. They have to organize the food. And some of the foods that they were receiving weren't necessarily optimal for their clientele, for the groups and communities they were serving. And so we developed a middle point that is a production kitchen for the things that they can't use. And that's what the Good Food Project is. Essentially, instead of sending a group that doesn't have an oven or a can opener, a bunch of raw canned goods, it comes to me at the Good Food Project and we turn it into meals and then we give them something that's more accessible.
So individual meals.
Correct.
Great.
Yeah. And they're frozen. So we're taking food that has a 4-day window and extending its lifespan by about 9 months.
Wow. Awesome.
Thanks. These are great questions, by the way.
So with the preparation of those meals, you're not ordering the food. Like, here's what I want to make for these people today. And now I'm going to go place an order. You're getting food and
getting
creative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. And who's doing that preparation besides you?
Well, I did it for the last 3 years. And then I hired an assistant who is so good that I don't have to do as much, which is great. She just celebrated her year anniversary with us. Her name's Alexa.
Oh, very nice.
And, look out for her. She'll be seeing big things from her.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So the other project that I wanted to ask you about, just because I love the name, was Ugly CSA. Mm-hmm. What is this? This ugly food in the CSA?
Yeah. If you're familiar, I mean, I'm sure you've perhaps seen the Misfits boxes. It's essentially, so a CSA is a great way for farms to secure money in seasons when they don't necessarily have cash. What this does is takes anything that would have not been perfect looking and ideal from the farms. We gather it all up and we sell shares in order to fundraise, essentially. And so you can order a CSA, and if you're, you know, it's a way to both mitigate waste and support our work in buying a share with the CSA. And then you get
very cool,
wonderful produce. I think it's weekly. So for throughout the summer.
Well, you all have been so creative with ways to maximize your opportunities. I saw on your website that you even rent out your kitchen space.
Do we? Something like that. What do we do?
Oh, you know what? I may have had that wrong. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. If we could, we would. It's usually pretty busy. What we do with our kitchen space is have volunteers join us in the preparation of that food. So when you asked earlier, yeah, who does that prep, it's people like you as well. Great. As Alexa.
So where are your challenges? Is it with that getting food moving for finding the food? Do you ever have trouble with
finding the food's easy?
Is it
finding the food is the food is everywhere. Anywhere there's a grocery store, distributor, restaurant, of which there are many. I think our main challenge is getting into new areas. Obviously, the same question of who do we serve? This will be a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
We try to serve any groups that are not within walking distance of a grocery store. Anybody who's been redlined, anybody who's suffering from the effects of food apartheid, anybody who needs access, right?
Right.
Sometimes, especially in Pittsburgh, the topography is the biggest challenge, and our perceptions of where we will and won't go as Pittsburghers. If you don't want to cross a bridge, if you don't want to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Those areas are exactly what are our challenges, and okay, getting people like yourselves to help us secure food for the people in those areas.
Okay. Okay. Well, that leads right into the how can we help? How else can these fine people help or take messages back to their friends and family of this cool program?
So glad you asked. My colleague Haley has some materials. She'll be able to distribute after this whole session. There's a website, 412foodrescue.org, that you can volunteer by driving. You can volunteer your time with me in the kitchen. Any of those avenues, and she'll be able to share those with you.
Well, great. Thanks for bringing that material for us, because I know we'll want to participate in this effort. So Chef Greg Austin, everyone, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Very good. So next this morning, we have Jennifer Flanagan from Community Kitchen Pittsburgh. There you go.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. You guys have a beautiful facility here. I love the outdoor sanctuary.
So Jennifer, you're founder of the Community Kitchen Pittsburgh. So if you would start us off with the origin story, how did this start up?
So I have to start with sort of my origin story. I was in New York City in on the corporate side of things when 9/11 happened, and I was actually in publishing. I worked in the finance division of a publishing house, and so I lost a lot of my authors in the towers. And I decided at that point to change my life. I quit my job. I joined AmeriCorps Vista. I chose Pittsburgh as my city and got into nonprofit work. So I started a similar program underneath another nonprofit, and then that one got acquired by a larger nonprofit, and I went to work for the county and decided I was done. And then my funders actually came to me and said, this project wasn't done yet. Started again as a separate C3. And so in 2013, that's what I did. So that's kind of the long and short of it. We combine workforce development with hunger relief. So it's kind of an interesting model that we do, but I really liked the idea of, it's like helping a social problem through market forces is kind of how I look at it. But I'll let you ask the questions and I'll answer them, because I can just keep talking and talking about this.
Please do. Well, the idea of having workforce development and providing education and jobs, it sounds like that just is critical to your mission. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So we're considered an employment-based social enterprise. So we run food businesses in order to employ and train individuals that have barriers to employment. And so we serve people who are coming out of incarceration, who are transitioning from homelessness, who may have dropped out of high school. Sometimes we serve people who are underemployed. They're stuck in a low-wage job. They do not have the money or the education to switch careers. So those are the kinds of people that we help. And then we integrate that into our food services. And so we do have some retail market-based businesses like a catering division. We do events, we have a cafe, and then we also have a hunger relief side, which is where we serve shelters. We send food to other nonprofits serving vulnerable populations. The new shelter downtown, Second Avenue Commons, we actually do all the food service for them. We average 8,000 meals a month through that facility. We typically serve between 400 and 500,000 meals a year through our community meals program. So it's a lot. And our training is integrated into that production. And our training is actually, we have articulation with CCAC. So our individuals who come through the program, they do get 15 credits toward an associate's degree for finishing our program. We have Department of Labor apprenticeships. So that's a 2,000 hour longer term kind of career pathway program. So it's a very much an integrated, we have a set curriculum and we set the menus based on what we're trying to teach, right? So if we're teaching mother sauces, something's going to end up on the menu that derives from that. And so it's a very integrated program. And, and then we also do the social service side. We have case managers and social workers on staff. We help people kind of address those barriers. And then we help them get employment. We have some really great employers, career pathway kinds of jobs, way, way above minimum wage. You know, our folks are going out at $18 to $20 an hour, which is really great for people who don't have a work history.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're serving that many meals, these are the students preparing the meals?
Yeah. We have two chefs in the kitchen. We have two apprentices that are in our apprenticeship program. And then it's students.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot. A lot of food goes out every day.
Indeed. Indeed. And then that helps to fund your program as well?
So we do about 60% of our operating budget comes through our food services, and the other 40% is raised. And our operating budget's $3 million. So we do get a lot of it through our food services. But then again, you know, we still have to raise between $800,000 and $1 million every year. Yeah.
So you knew this question was coming since I screwed it up the first time.
You also rent your kitchen out. Yes, we do actually rent our kitchen out. We actually support small food entrepreneurs. So if you are working out of your home kitchen and you want to kind of get to the next level, we will rent out our kitchen. We rent it out at below market rate. A lot of the folks that rent our kitchen are minority women. And we're trying to get them to kind of help their businesses get along. We have some small co-packers that we just had a guy, we call it graduating. His business got big enough that now he's at a commercial co-packer, but he started out in our kitchen. He was making hot sauce. So we try to support people that way. We'll carry their products in their cafe. And a lot of the folks that come to us, they don't know what they need. So we help them get their permits. We kind of help them through the process of getting their business legal and getting them into channels. So we do rent our kitchens out in the evenings and weekends. And sometimes we have small caterers that they get a big job and they can't do it in their home kitchen. So, you know, and then our students get to help if they so choose. So they get kind of wrapped into that. And our feeling is if their businesses take off, it's another employer for our people. So we like to support that side of things too as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So tell me about the cafe, Bloom.
Bloom. Yes. We are actually located on Flowers, and we were talking earlier, I'm a master gardener, so we like the bloom on Flowers. Anyway, it's open from 11 to 2. We're going to be expanding those hours to breakfast as well. We're there anyway, Monday through Friday, and it's a really great opportunity to give our students a different side of training. We look at everything as training, and so they get to learn a little bit of front of house, customer service. They get to kind of interact with people a little bit more. So that's kind of why we do it. And it's a la carte as opposed to the institutional side where we're doing these, you know, high volume meals. This is more a la carte. Somebody comes in, they order food. You have to make the ticket right away. You might have 10 customers at one time. So it's a different kind of training for our folks. And it's a nice opportunity for them to see that side of things.
Now, does that follow the same model of what they're learning is what's on the menu, or is that more stable, the menu at Bloom?
Oh, no, it's absolutely. We change the menu up, but it's really about, for example, we have a grain salad on the menu, and that's because a lot of our students aren't familiar with things like quinoa. Right. And so we try to put things on the menu that they're going to kind of learn about different ways to cook different ingredients that they might not have seen before.
Great.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I had seen was this partnership with UPMC, which is a fairly good sized organization in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
So this is a really great opportunity for us. We were seeing, especially after COVID, people weren't finishing our program. They needed a job faster. And our program is only 3 months, but for some people, they can't do that. They can't do a 3-month program. And so they were exiting early. And so we started talking to UPMC about creating a pipeline into UPMC. So now we have this program where you can come to us for 4 to 6 weeks and then move right into a career pathway job at UPMC Food Services. And it's really a nice program. So we just piloted this, and the first 6 people that came through the program, all 6 of them got jobs. And they're starting at 18, which is amazing. They get benefits. UPMC has a lot of really great benefits for folks, from childcare to paying for additional schooling to all kinds of things. And so it's been a really nice, and they're working with us on, it depends on your criminal background. It's not a blanket rule anymore. They kind of look at how old the charge was, what the charge was. And so that's another thing that we do with employers, is to really try to work with them on modifying their hiring practices to accommodate more people, and looking at it case by case rather than just having a blanket rule.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And we've looked at that here as well, where, sentences are given to people who offend, but then the community continues to punish them
right
forever sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that's awesome work. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, we do a lot of work with folks transitioning out of incarceration. It's an important part of what we do. Right. And we hire that way too. I like to say we hire close to mission, but we have to walk the walk, right? So a lot of our staff are as well coming from that same population.
That's great. So the hunger relief piece, is that food prep or sharing food, or
so we actually we actually get a lot of food for 412 Food Rescue. They're a huge partner of ours. But we are one of those facilities that can take raw product and turn it into meals. And so that's what we do. We take the raw product. For us, it's an added benefit because they actually give us some really great, they'll give us fresh herbs, and we immediately have a product identification class first, and then we use the product. So we use a lot of their materials that they give us for teaching as well, which is great because we get such a nice variety from 412. So, but we do turn it into meals, and then we send it out. And so during COVID, we actually delivered meals right to our community. We were doing about 1,000 meals a day we're over in the Hazelwood community. But we typically don't serve directly to a home. We typically interface with another nonprofit. The closest that we get, we have a program, it's called Hello Baby. It is through the county. And we are delivering family meals to new moms that are identified as being at risk by the county. And Meals on Wheels actually delivers the meals. So they come pick up the meals from us, and then we deliver 6 weeks of meals to new moms that are in need. So that's actually a nice program that we do. But that's the closest we get to delivering right to a home. Typically, we are going through another nonprofit that's taking the meals. Like, we work with Veterans Place. We work with Bethlehem Haven Women's Shelter, Peer Support and Advocacy, the Second Avenue Colony. Great. So there's a lot of other nonprofits. And then we're sponsors for the Tribe Nutrition Programs. These are the summer and after school meals for kids that are on the free and reduced lunch programs. So we serve those meals as well.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. It's fascinating to hear how much you've got going on, and yet you can be so nimble. Like, here's a bunch of parsley, go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. It's like Iron Chef, and you do this every day. So, you know exactly what that's like. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun for our students too, to kind of let them explore and come up with new things. And yeah. It gives better food to the individuals, right? Because for a lot of the folks that we serve, our food is the only food they get all day, right? And so it's important to make it good. And I always like to tell our students, if you wouldn't eat it, if you wouldn't serve it to your mother or your grandmother, we are not serving it out of here. And, we have this interesting thing where we're doing catering. We might be catering a board meeting, and we're also serving homeless shelters. And I always tell everyone, there shouldn't really be a lot of difference between this food. And there's a lot of dignity in being invited to the table. And we are it is important for us to kind of make sure that the there's dignity in preparing the food and there's dignity in receiving that food. That's a really important message that we give to our students all the time. And for a lot of our students, they have come through this. They might've been living in that shelter or their kids are on the free and reduced lunch program. And so there's a whole thing that happens where they are finding themselves on the other side and giving back. And it's actually very transformative for people to be on the other side of it.
Well, tell us, we'll end up with this, of the how we can help. Should we all come have lunch at Bloom?
Absolutely. So support our businesses, right? So we do have events. We have a guest chef event every month. That's when we invite a chef from the community to come in, and they work with our students all day. And then we have a ticketed dinner. That's a really nice way to support us. Come to our cafe, use our catering. We always take donations. And I will say, for those of you who frequent fish fries, we have one of the best fish fries in the city. so come visit us in the spring. It's actually our biggest fundraiser of the year. And it's a really fun time.
Oh, we'll keep an eye out.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Jennifer Flanagan, everyone. Thank you. So next, we have our own Sue Weibel, who gets a mic. Sue has been working so very hard on this first-time project through Allegheny County of Seed to Supper. So we'll learn about that now. Tell us about this Seed to Supper program. And I understand it started out in Oregon.
Yes, it started in Oregon in conjunction with the Oregon Food Bank and Oregon State Extension. And that was 15 years ago. And in 2020, Penn State Extension received permission to adapt the program to Pennsylvania and their growing conditions. Since then, it's been offered in 20 counties, but as Carol mentioned, this was the first offering in Allegheny County, and the class ran from April 1st to June 24th. Seed to Supper is a 7-week comprehensive beginning gardening class, and it's designed to teach low-income participants how to garden at home on a budget. We accepted 10 students into the class, and that's pretty much the recommended class size, and it's free to all the students.
So low-income participation. So how did you solicit participation of the low-income adults that you needed?
Well, as you can see on the slide above, we had several partnerships that we established early on. SHIM is our most important partner, and that's who we went to. We were invited to go to their 3 local pantries to recruit students for the program. And just by being a client of the pantries, they qualify. Westminster, the Outreach Commission, took us under their wing, and they provided us classroom space, AV equipment, kitchen facilities, setup, breakdown, and couldn't have been more accommodating. Walt was a real champ for us. So we also, the Historical Society of Upper St. Clair, which is across the street, Gilfillan Farm, we have that relationship with them, but they supplied us the space to do 2 demonstration beds for Seed to Supper. And they also held our grant, which was a generous grant from the Garden Club of Allegheny County.
Nice. So back to your participants being low income, even gardening at home, I mean, it can be expensive getting all the supplies. They probably didn't have a lot of gardening equipment ready at the ready. How did you handle that?
And that's where that's why we applied for the grant.
Okay.
Primarily to cover all those costs. And what we gave each student was hand tools, gloves, growing containers, soil. We had 6 yards of soil from AgriCycle delivered. Soil testing, all the amendments they needed, trellis kits, and we had all their plants and seeds that they chose to grow.
Oh, cool.
So
that's great. So I'm interested in the soil testing that you included there and doing that for them. Why was that so important?
There's basic soil testing, which you may be familiar, NPK, but we also wanted to make sure anyone who was growing in ground versus container gardening had their soil tested for heavy metals. It's a much more intense kind of process. Okay. But we tested for arsenic, lead, and cadmium. And arsenic was, well, my actual partner, fellow master gardener, lives about a half a mile from here, and her garden tested very high for arsenic. And we suspect that it's from old farming practices. There are a lot of orchards around here, and arsenic was used as a pesticide. So it's still in the soil after all these decades. And that can be taken by your particularly root vegetables. And another student tested very high with cadmium levels. They had 1,050 parts per million, and 2.5 parts per million is the safe level. So, and that was just in Brentwood. So our recommendation for them was to totally grow in containers and just be careful with their kids playing in the yard, that they're, you know, so those were real issues to be concerned about.
That's great that you had that as part of the program. So this is essentially training for these people. What were the topics that you covered then, along with providing them all that equipment?
Well, we started with planting your garden. It's choosing the site and also creating a planting map. And that's where the students decided what they wanted to plant. Then we moved into healthy soils and touched on a lot of stuff that Dan mentioned last week, no-till, various things like that. Then planting your garden, that's where our demo beds over at Gilfillan came into play. We used those to teach people how to plant. Caring for your growing garden covered pest management and disease control. Okay. And then we had food preparation and food preservation. And we were very fortunate to have Rainia Harris become a master gardener this past year. And you might be familiar, she does cooking segments on Pittsburgh Today. So she did a great job with that. And we had another master gardener who's actually a master food preserver. And she taught people how to dry, freeze, and can their harvest.
Wow.
So it was great.
Does everybody want to take this class now? I do. So it does sound like it took a village here of people participating, with not just you involved. So who were your volunteers for the program?
Well, most of the people, it is a program, a master gardener program.
Okay.
So we rely on a lot of the master gardener expertise. We had experienced master gardeners teaching each class. We had a lot of master gardener volunteers who were in the classroom as mentors and classroom aides. And then we had our own Barb Myers, who was our Westminster representative, and she attended every class.
Awesome.
She's also my right hand over at the Gilfillan Farm.
That's great. So this was, since this was the first time that it was delivered here in Allegheny County, I mean, you had to, even though it was a program that existed, you kind of had to invent it here and get everything off the ground its first year. What were some of the challenges that caused you to think maybe we'd do it a little differently next time? Did you come up with any of that?
Transportation is a big issue for a lot of our folks. We had one woman from just near Bethel Bakery had to take 2 T's to get here, and we'd have to pick her up to bring her down.
Mm-hmm.
Another student, you know, car issues. So even if they're able to get here, there's all kinds of interference, you know, or obstacles that come up. So we're going to look into ways to provide transportation through volunteer support. We won't be able to do that for everyone, but it would be, we'd want to make sure if anyone has that obstacle, we can help them out. Also, you know, as you can imagine, people's work schedules change. So it's a big commitment, 7 weeks over 3 months. Mm-hmm. But we'll look at ways of consolidating and organizing the classes to be a little bit more conducive for students' commitment. Also, language was a barrier. Coming from the Shim pantries, a good portion of our students were Bhutanese refugees.
Okay.
And they had to be able to speak English to take the class, but they had limited English. We had one student, though, who was a native of India, who's been in the country forever, speaks fluent English. And she recognized that a lot of these students also spoke Hindi and was able to take them aside and translate throughout the class. So that student, as well as another Bhutanese refugee student, they want to come and volunteer next year and help us out.
Oh, nice.
And if they're not able to, we'll look into getting interpreters or translators.
Okay. Well, very good. That'll make it even easier for them. That's great. So I know you're in between program deliveries now. You've finished up this first one, and it sounds like you're looking to do it again. But how can people help you even in the meantime?
Well, we are going to look at ways to get other volunteers, particularly from the church, community, or partners, to help with the program, which will probably start up again next March or April. But in the meantime, right across the street, we have the Shim Garden, which is, it has its work days are Monday mornings, 9 to 11. There are a lot of volunteers sitting in this room today. And we welcome anyone. You don't have to have any gardening experience. Come on down. Just stop by and visit. If you feel like you want to stay and help out, that'd be great.
So you don't need to register to come?
No, you just show up. Okay. If there's thunder or lightning, don't come. But a lot of metal fencing and things. But in general, we're there. And just check us out. We love to talk about what we're doing. Everything, again, if you're not familiar, goes to the Shim Pantry, is delivered that morning, and then it's distributed. We're one of 12 gardens over there. And all that produce comes in Monday and Tuesday, and then it's distributed for their pantries throughout the week.
Great. Great. So, well, that is a worthwhile cause. Maybe we will stop by.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, Sue Weibel, everyone, thank you very much. Don't go anywhere. Oh, hang on just one moment, please. If we could invite our panelists to come back up. This is our question answer period. So we'll pass around a mic for people in the room, for people online. Unmute yourselves and feel free to ask questions as well. And please indicate to whom you are addressing your question.
Sue, how many pounds of produce do you contribute? I know one year it sounded like 3,000 pounds or something.
Our garden across the street, last year we gave 2,400 pounds of produce. The year before was 3,000. Right now we're at 284, but our tomatoes, squash, peppers haven't come in yet. That's a lot of greens. So it's a lot of greens.
And one more question. On your class, did you happen to bring one of the little cookbook pamphlets that all of them contributed recipes?
No, I didn't, but I can share that with anyone who's interested. We asked our participants, both instructors and students, to provide their favorite vegetable recipes, and we created a cookbook, which Westminster graciously printed for us. It's a 20-page little cookbook, so...
I just want to comment that I think all three of these projects are really amazing, and kudos to you all. But the one I wanted to just comment on, because I've heard this expression for years, if you give a person a fish, they eat for one day. If you teach them how to fish, they do it forever. And I think the project that Sue described, as well as some of the others, is such a great example of that. So keep going. It also fits with Presbyterian sustainability.
Zucchinis. What do you do when you get an overload of zucchinis? that's kind of my joke. But what blows me away is it sounds really easy to do what you're doing, but I think of the necessity to fundraise and taking you away from the fun part and the emotional rewarding part of your business. And my hat's off to the volunteers who pursue that aspect and keep it alive. And does it help to seek information or what's worked in other communities, other cities? Are you involved in networking with other people?
So we are actually part of a national network called Catalyst Kitchens, and there's about 80 programs like ours around the country that do very similar work. And we very much rely on each other in terms of best practices. Has this worked? Have you tried this? We actually have our biannual summit is in August. And so there's a whole team of us flying down to North Carolina to visit that program, and they're hosting all of us. But we definitely, we don't want to reinvent the wheel at all. And so we definitely try to learn from what works elsewhere, what hasn't worked elsewhere.
Absolutely. Just to echo Jen, we, through the development of the app, have connected up to, I think, 30 other cities with our technology. And so we share information amongst that network and figure out best practices the same way. Thank you. Yeah. And as far as zucchini, if it's, I think the most creative thing I've done is hummus. It can be done.
We have a question from online in the chat. It's for Community Kitchen.
I guess Pittsburgh Food Bank would be the biggest distributor of food in the Pittsburgh area. Do you all coordinate in any manner, or how do you identify the populations that are in most of need, or is it you target an area that you know has a need and you sort of do it on your own? I guess broader question, is there any coordination in Pittsburgh across with Pittsburgh Food Bank and others?
Yeah, so we are a member agency of the food bank, and we do get a lot of food from them. So for example, the summer feeding program for the kids on free and reduced, there's actually a map that all of the agencies that do this work, it identifies all of the existing locations where food is distributed. So then you can see where the holes are, and the food bank actually coordinates, okay, who's in that area, who can fill those needs. So there's a lot of coordination done through the food bank. That's just one example, but they do try to convene for sure. You know, there's a month, there's at least, well, we're on three monthly meetings that have to do with food distribution. So there's definitely an effort to coordinate.
Will online has a question for Community Kitchen.
And also Shim works closely with the food bank. They actually provide a lot of like carrots, onions, and potatoes. So for that reason, we don't grow those things. So, but they all, you know, offer a lot of produce in that regard. We try to offer and fill in the gaps with everything else.
And just like both of my colleagues up here said, that same kind of effort exists at the city level, at the county level, at the healthcare, throughout the healthcare units. So there's a concerted effort that you can kind of, it's kind of visible, extra visible now with Mayor Ganey and the Food Policy Council kind of bringing it to the people. I don't know that much about it.
Well, so there is a Food Policy Council here in Pittsburgh, and it's a really active one, and social justice is a big part of what they do. And they look at things like workforce development as well as the food side of it. And so there's a lot of agencies that are involved in the Food Policy Council, and the city actually has representation on the council as well. So that's another, glad you mentioned that. It's a good organization that they do try to do a lot of policy and, like I said, social justice efforts through that council.
I'm going to double dip and ask two questions. So can you tell me how people are chosen for the seed to supper? How do you know who will participate? Are there criteria for that? Or
as far as our student participants?
Yes. Yes.
This first pilot program, we made a requirement that students needed to be able to speak English, and we weren't providing childcare. Down the road, we may try to overcome those obstacles and barriers, but going through the food pantry, definitely everyone needs to qualify to use the pantry. So we knew we were hitting a target audience.
Okay, we have a question online. I'm sorry, I have to read it. I was trying to do it. Okay.
For Community Kitchen Pittsburgh, what are the biggest obstacles for an individual to continue as a participant in your program, and how do the social workers and program help folks stay in the program?
So let's see. Staying clean and sober, we do have a lot of people that are coming out of addiction, and that's a hard thing to overcome. So that's something that is, we see that a lot. We see relapse a lot. And, you know, we try to connect people to whatever, like, we don't want to reinvent the wheel on that side either. So a lot of what we're doing is connecting people to existing services. Some of the things, just smaller things that we try to do to keep people engaged, right? Transportation is an issue. We provide bus passes. Everybody gets a bus pass. Food is always an issue. So we feed everybody every day, but they can also take food home with them. Everyone gets a stipend while they're there. So just they have some cash to kind of do what they need to do. We have a student assistance fund. So actually all the tips and donations from the fish fry every year fund our student assistance fund. And so we just had two homeless individuals. We paid their first month and security deposit to secure them housing. So we really, it's housing. Childcare is another big one. Childcare is probably the hardest. There's very limited childcare options for folks. We have to sometimes modify schedules because we have people who have to take three buses to get their kid to a childcare facility and then get over to us. So we try to work with people, kind of meet them where they are and take them to the next step. But there's definitely a lot of barriers that folks are overcoming.
Two questions, and maybe it's towards the 412 or 412 program. You mentioned that you pick up from restaurants. Is that the bulk food that they haven't used, or do you actually pick up if they've prepared too much zucchini or, you know, macaroni? Is it actually that type of food you pick up? And second of all, with the app, is that the app down to the actual user level? Someone can say, I'm hungry today, or I didn't have a meal, and they can request that food be brought to you in that manner. Is it that technologically sophisticated at this point?
Not yet. The for the history of the app usage, we've been primarily a B2B, a business-to-business connection. Our program, we have a nascent home delivery program that we're figuring the kinks out as far as how to get to the directly to recipients. The first part of that question was prepared foods. Yes. It's mostly prepared foods from restaurants. And then we go to the distributors. We go closer to the source to get those more source-like products. Does that answer your question?
Must be a whole different issue with, you know, the famous turkey. You can't leave your turkey out for more than, you know, 2 hours after Thanksgiving, or it's going to be bad news. I guess that's got to be a real challenge to make sure that you're not running into those types of issues.
Correct. Yeah. I believe the statistic is under a half hour for us. 99.5% of our rescues happen under a half hour. The safety requirement on that is 4 hours. Something we're a little proud of, I guess.
I'm just curious, does Giant Eagle contribute?
They do. They're our biggest contributor in 2022, I believe. And huge partner for us. And they love doing it. Honestly, they're a passionate partner for us.
Can I just add something? So an organization like 412 for us is really great because they are consolidating the food and bringing it to us in a truck, right? So they're dealing with Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or Giant Eagle or wherever. And we just get it delivered to our facility in a nice refrigerated box truck. And it's great. And it's really helpful for us because it reduces for us the amount of legwork we have to do to get that donation in. So kudos to 412. I just want to say that. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Are there any other questions online from our participants online?
Community Kitchens, do you have a restaurant? Can we come for lunch? Is that so?
Yes, we have a cafe. It's open from 11 to 2 Monday through Friday. It's over in Hazelwood, right on 2nd Avenue and Flowers in Hazelwood. So it's right on the main drag. You can't miss us. Yeah.
Like a field trip to me.
Absolutely. Yep.
I'm hearing about farms being sold because they're not profitable, and sometimes being sold to housing development companies. And there's also a problem of climate change and its effect on the availability of food. And I guess a lot of us assume that food's always going to be available, even, you know, the well-off folks that don't worry about it. I'm not sure what the question is, but do you have any comments on farms, climate change, and how that affects the supply of food for all of us?
I think I would say, with a caveat, right? Because when we are using donated food, we're going to accept the food no matter where it comes from, but we're making a conscious effort to work with our local producers. So, for example, we started a butchery program. It's a training program, but we are, you know, we're going through our USDA grant of inspection, but we only source from local producers for that. And so we are sourcing, you know, animals from really a pretty small circle around our facility and getting them processed and then selling the meat. We're going to get our EBT so that we can accept, you know, basic food stamps basically for people to buy that local meat. We're trying to make the effort to support our local producers. And that is one thing that Food Policy Council really looks at is our regional food shed. Because if we don't support our regional producers, they will go away. 100%. And so I think that you're seeing a lot more restaurants trying to support that local, you know, trying to support that. You see it on menus all the time, right? They're supporting their local. But it is a fact. If we do not support our local producers, our small farms, they will go away. And that will hurt us because, you know, I mean, you guys all know this. It's the large scale production is great on some levels, and it's harmful on other levels, for sure. I'm sure as a chef, you have some things to say about that as well.
Yeah, I would love to add to that. One of the great things about partners like Jen who love getting whatever from us is that none of that's going in the landfill, which is the other part of our mission, is to reduce methane emissions. So the more food that we can capture and rescue and put into hands that can work with it, the more we mitigate emissions, to speak to what you're speaking to. And you're directly gardening, you're farming.
Yeah.
That's good.
Chef Greg, in your presentation, you mentioned something CSS. That's what is that? I'm not familiar with it.
What is it called? A community supported agriculture. Yeah. Thank you. Perfect. Community supported agriculture.
It's a great program. So, you know, regional farms have CSAs, and so it allows them to sell the shares of their product before they grow, right? And so they're basically getting the investment for their next season's worth of crops from the community. So you buy a share, and you can get your. And so then they, you don't. Some farms are. You know, you get more of a choice. Other ones, you kind of get what they grow. And so then you pick up your box somewhere in your local community every week. And so you're basically buying a share in that farm in advance and allows the farmer to plan their season. And it's a profitable approach. And Harvey is a big aggregator of CSAs. And so now it's actually an interesting model where they are now working with all these local farms and they're aggregating. It's called Harvey Farms. So you can get a CSA through Harvey. And then you have more choice because they are now working with a bunch of farms. And I heard that there's actually going to be someone doing the same thing on the meat side, and they're going to be working with a bunch of regional farms to aggregate the meat for the same reason, is to try to create this regional demand for a local food shed. So, but CSAs are great, and ugly CSA. Yeah. It's great because, you know, when you go to a Whole Foods, it's just beautiful. It's just a beautiful display of beautiful food, which is great, except that there's a lot of food that isn't beautiful. And there's typically not been a retail outlet for that. It just gets thrown away because nobody wants to buy it, which is why it's so great that these guys have the ugly CSA, because there's nothing wrong with that food. It just doesn't look as pretty as the displays that you see at Whole Foods. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
really don't like public speaking, so that's why I'm sitting here. I just wanted to note about climate change with our organization. Since we've been active from 2015, our volunteers have mitigated over 18 million pounds of CO2 here in Pittsburgh, totally saving around 22 million pounds of food here in Pittsburgh in the past 8 years. Last year was 4 million alone. So you think about...
It adds up.
Exactly.
Thank you.
And then additionally, with the Harvey boxes that you get, if you are out of town or you're not doing something and you aren't able to access that box that week, you can donate it. And one of our volunteers will go pick it up and deliver it to a home in need.
Thank you so much, Haley.
And any other questions online from participants? Okay, well, I want to thank our presenters today, Jennifer and Greg and Sue, for a wonderful presentation and so informative. And I know that we can all go to the websites for all of these organizations where you can, and you can show up tomorrow morning across the street and help us pick green beans tomorrow, I'll bet. And I'd also like to thank Carol Galbraith for doing a wonderful job in interviewing today. So thank you all very much.